Hello, welcome to Universal Soul Love. This is Detective David Love.
And this is Dr. Lana Love. Welcome to our show.
We're broadcasting live on the BBS Radio Network from the land down under, and we're with our special guest, Derek Jensen, co-founder of Deep Green Resistance.
Derek is an author and radical environmentalist. According to Democracy Now!, Jensen has been called a poet philosopher of the ecological movement. Pleasure to have you on our show, Derek. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for having me back.
Yeah, absolutely. We had a great interview with you before. We were talking a lot about your background and your experiences and a little bit about Deep Green Resistance and the origins. So I thought we'd bring you back on today to talk about our moral obligation or moral imperative when it comes to protection of the environment and defense of other living creatures, and what your views are on that.
Well, I can either dive into that, or if you want to ask me a more specific question, then that's great too, either way.
Well, why don't you perhaps answer that question, and then we might go more into specifics. It's an important question, isn't it? Do we have the responsibility of looking after our home? And, you know, is it self-protection?
I mean, we just finished the Paradigm Shift Conference recently, and we had Bruce Lipton and Andrew Harvey and a number of others, Alexander Metters. We had some excellent speakers, and they all talked about the sixth mass extinction of the planet, particularly Bruce Lipton started out with that, and that sort of set the trend for the entire conference. And so, and that really actually hit me very hard, because I wasn't expecting the conference to go in that direction, and it became quite heavy. And even Andrew Harvey said, when I mentioned, I was thinking that when we had him on our show before, he was talking a lot about love, and it was very inspiring. And he said, in fact, I am being very inspiring when I talk about this. He said, mystics or philosophers are here to comfort the comforted and antagonize. Sorry, how did he say
comfort,
that? He
said it was to the comfortable.
Yes. And so he said, I'm being inspiring when I'm being very direct and very with the things he said. So, and it's true.
He was very much of the opinion that it's actually our responsibility to do something.
Hmm. Well,
take action.
I love the word responsibility. The word responsibility comes from the root respondere, which means to give in return. And if there is such a thing as a moral obligation, and we can talk about morality in a minute, then certainly we owe an obligation to the planet that is our only home and that has given us life. We owe it to that planet to defend it from those who would kill it. And again, I, the root is respondere, to give in return. And you know, I think the most important question that any of us can ask is the world a better place because you were born and because of how you lived your life? And by world, I don't mean capitalism and I don't mean industrialism. I mean the real physical world. I mean this. Mm-hmm. Is it a better place because you were born? And, you know, we've been taught that evolution is based on competition, survival of the fittest, survival of the meanest, survival of those who exploit the most capitalist, really. And I can disprove that in one sentence if you give me a couple semicolons, which is those creatures who have survived in the long run have survived in the long run, semicolon. You don't survive in the long run by hyper-exploiting your surroundings, semicolon. You survive in the long run by improving your habitat. That's what you do. Because if your habitat is at 100 units of health, and then because you're there, you take it down to 99, and then your children take it to 98, and their children take it to 97, 100 generations is down to zero. That's not a plan with the future. And, you know, think about it. How did the world get to be so extraordinary in the first place? And it all happened because of everybody living and dying and making the world a better place by living and dying. And so again, the question is the world a better place because you were born? And now I want to go to morality for a second. And morality is kind of a tough one because we've been because there's sort of a Christian morality that can be, when people think about morality, sometimes they think about simply unnecessary restrictions based upon people. You know, it's like you shouldn't have sex outside of marriage, or, you know, whatever other, you know, moralities we want to pop up. But then they have this silly idea, and a not very mature idea, that somehow because some moralities aren't helpful, that all moralities are unhelpful. And so morality itself gets a bad name. And this is really true in the whole philosophy known as postmodernism, where they argue that basically all there are stories, and no story is better than any other story. And you just argue for a story. I got in an argument with a friend of mine 20, almost 30 years ago now. She was dating a postmodern philosopher at the time, and she and I went to dinner. And during the dinner, I happened to say something about rape being bad. And she, remember, she was dating a postmodern philosopher, and so she was temporarily insane. She said, well, no, rape isn't bad. We can say that rape is bad, but all morality is based on what we say. And so we can just argue about, you know, that. And it took me a while to come up with an answer. And the answer I got really came from Charlene Spretnak, the great eco-philosopher. And the answer I eventually gave her was, no, not everything is based on stories. And we can build our morality around this. And I held up a glass of water. And I said, without drinkable quantities of clean water, you die. Therefore, we can make the case that drinkable quantities of clean water are moral and good, no matter what stories you tell yourself. Now, you can tell yourself a story that says that money is more important than water. You can tell yourself a story that says that money is more important than clean air. By the way, just 10 minutes ago, before we came on, I read a news article that said that there are more people today getting lung cancer from pollution than getting it from smoking cigarettes. And that's because pollution is so bad. So you can argue, or I'll tell you another story about this real quick, and then we'll get back to morality, I guess. There's my niece is married to a man from China. And they were visiting, and we had to go get something from Walmart. And before you freak out at me going to Walmart, I live in a small town. Walmart's already destroyed all the other places. So, you know, he had to get something, and where are you going to go to get whatever crap it was? So we go over to Walmart. And as we're standing outside the store, he says to me, I got to tell you, he's not a lefty. He's not environmentalist. He's not any of that stuff. But as we're standing outside the store, he said to me, you know, when I was a child, the skies in China were still pretty blue. And then they got to be gray, and then they got to be brown, and now they're pretty black. And it's all so you can have cheap plastic crap at Walmart. Mm. So this culture has declared that money is worth more than clean air. I would argue that that's profoundly immoral. And it's also suicidal.
She sounds insane.
It's completely insane. And so it's insane the fact that we even have to have this discussion about whether it would be moral to stop this culture from killing the planet. And like that's how crazy this culture is. I mean, what could be more immoral than destroying the only source of life that we know of in the entire universe? Like, you'd have to be really hard to come
up with. You can't argue with that.
With more immoral than that. So, okay, so basically, my morality starts with the understanding that, and you know, this is just Aldo Leopold's land ethic, really, that whatever serves the land base is, as a default, moral. I mean, that doesn't mean that I'm going to go kill 17 babies and put them in the ground because they can fertilize the trees. I mean, that's it's not just like that, but it is that, as a whole, something that tends to increase the health of the land would tend to be more moral than something that does not. And so for me, that's where our morality starts. So that sort of, you know, is the tip of the iceberg for talking about morality and earth defense. And you know, I was asked the other day by someone if I could condense, it was an interviewer from Austria who said, If you could say one thing to the people of Austria about what your work is about, condense it all to one sentence, what would it be? What do you want from people? And I said, what I want is for them to, except of course it took me 45 minutes to get here. I said, what I want is for people to transfer their loyalty away from this culture and to the land and to the oceans and to the land base. And that's really everything I'm talking about, is remembering that you're an animal who needs habitat. And once you remember that, everything else becomes technical.
It's interesting because I was just thinking that the morality of the land, what's good for the land, may be at odds with what's good for humans at first glance, not obviously in the long term. But you could argue that, you know, people need their jobs, and therefore we need to have this industrialization. You could also argue that, you know, poachers, the poachers that kill off elephants, they need to feed their families. But of course, in the long run, obviously what's good for the land is good for people. Sure. In the short, in the first instance, though, people will argue that they need jobs, they need to have income.
And there's endless arguments. I mean, I worked in the U.S. court system with lawyers. There's endless, even with philosophy, and we did it. We had a Buddhist class last night. And there are always valid points on every side, really, if you care to be unbiased and neutral, if that's possible and objective. But they don't always add up, no matter how good those valid points are. In the long run, like you say, with future generations and in the long run.
Well, I guess the point is we have to somehow get across to people that they need to think long term and not short term.
Well, there's a really great book, one of the best books I've ever read, called The Nazi Doctors by Robert J. Lifton. And he's a great thinker, one of the most important thinkers of the 20th century, I think. And one of the questions he had as a Jewish person was how could doctors who had taken a Hippocratic oath go in and work in Nazi death camps? And he's not talking about Mengele. He does talk about Mengele some, but that's not his real point. He was just a sadist who was just dreadful. But there were a lot of doctors in the camps who actually cared for the health of the inmates, and they would do what they could. They would hide the inmates from selection officers who were going to kill them. They would give them an extra scrap of potato. They would let them rest for a day or two from the forced labor. They would put them to bed. They would do what they could, except for the most important thing of all, which is they wouldn't question the larger existence of the death camp itself. They would do every pathetic little thing they could, except for questioning working them to death, starving them to death, gassing them to death. And that's a position that I think a lot of environmentalists find ourselves in, and a lot of people in general, is that we will do everything we can to make things better, except for the most important thing of all, which is to question this larger death camp culture, to question the gassing the world to death, to question working it to death, to question starving it to death. And, you know, insect populations have gone down by 60 to 70% in the last 50 years too, as well as other wildlife. This is insane. This is crazy. This cannot continue. And another part I want to mention is that, yes, people need their jobs, but there is a Doobie Brothers album from the 70s. Were they big over there too? Doobie Brothers back in the day. So the Doobie Brothers had an album that was called, I believe, What Were Once Vices Are Now Habits. And we can say the same thing about luxuries, that a couple years ago in the local high school, they were trying to make it so students could no longer use their cell phones in class. And the students revolted. And it was an extraordinary thing because 15 years ago, nobody had cell phones. And now it is, or 20 years ago, nobody had cell phones. And now it is considered a right to have a cell phone in a classroom and a necessity. And think about computers, how quickly they have overtaken our entire lives. And we grew up back when people didn't have computers yet. And my point is not, oh, the good old days, even though they were good old days, frankly. That's not my point. My point is how quickly we come to require something and to consider it more important than sharks and more important than manta rays and more important than alligators and more important than the people who live in the regions where the coltan is mined, more important than mountain gorillas. And what we really need to come back to is also the word need. The truth is, I don't need a computer. Sure, I enjoy playing games on the computer. I enjoy doing this interview. I enjoy watching BBC movies with my mom on streaming, and that's all great. But we have to remember what is real, and what is real is food, air, and water. Mm. And another part of this that's really important to remember is I get accused sometimes, because I want to stop this culture from killing the planet, I sometimes get accused of wanting to commit genocide. And I was like, but I asked both Anuradha Mittal and Vandana Shiva, what would happen, for example, to the people of India if the global economy disappeared tomorrow? Because that's a real concern. You know, it's like, I want to bring down this culture, but what happens if the global economy disappears? And they both just laughed and said, the people of India would be better off immediately. Because, and we have to recognize that most of the human beings on the planet don't have access to electricity. If the electrical grid goes down, that's going to inconvenience and harm you and me, but it will not harm the poor subsistence farmers of India. In fact, there are former granaries of India that now export dog food and tulips to Europe because of the global economy. And I said to Vandana Shiva, what about the people of Mumbai? I mean, what about the people in the slums? Aren't they going to be in real trouble? And she said, no, why do you think they're in the slums? They're not in the slums because they want to live in the slums. They're in the slums because they were driven off their land by transnational corporations with the help of U.S.-backed Indian military and police forces. And if you stop that international trade in weapons and you stop the global – and you stop Coca-Cola from taking their land and taking their aquifers – they'll be back on the land doing their subsistence farming like they've done for the last 10,000 years. Mm-hmm. And there's another part of this that's really important. When we've talked before, have I told the story about the river flooding? Okay, you're looking critical, so I haven't. Okay, this is a story I love, and it's really important to this too. Well, and I want to say also before we continue that I say this as someone who has – I say all of this as someone who has Crohn's disease – and who is reliant on high-tech medicine for my life, that without an infusion that I get every other month, I would have been dead more than a decade ago, and I would probably die in 4 or 5 months. But the truth is that the health of the land is more important than me. I'm going to die anyway. The land doesn't have to die. And I've had a wonderful life, and I cannot complain. If I'll tell you one more story before we get to the river thing, which is more than 10 years ago now, maybe 10 years, I don't know, somebody said to me, you talk about blowing up dams and to save the rivers from salmon, and so would you take out a dam if it killed people you love? And I said, I have to think about that. And I went and I asked my mom and I asked the person I was dating at the time, and they both gave the same answer, which is, you damn well better have said yes, you'd blow it up. And that's because for the people in my community, the land is more important than my life. It's more important than your life. I love the line by Paul Stamets, "Nature loves a community." You know, if you really look at what happens in nature, for the most part, I don't believe nature really cares about the individual. It cares about the health of the community. That's what's always most important. We've made a big mistake in the whole selfish gene theory, in our looking at the way we look at evolution is all wrong, I think. It's not about the individual survival, and it's not about the individual genetic survival. It's about the survival of the larger community. But anyway, leave that aside. There's this great, when I was writing Endgame, I would talk about how, gosh, we need to take out dams. And one time this hydrologist came up to me and said, you know, you can't tell people that because if somebody takes out a dam, it will destroy the river. It's like, gosh, I don't know anything about this. So I started asking people. And I called up some fisheries biologists and I said, hey, so I'm just wondering, if somebody blew up a dam, would that help the fish or hurt the fish? Hello? they would just hang up with me, of course, because like, I'm not going to talk to a crazy person. But then I was doing an interview one time, a radio call-in interview, and people called in after I said, you know, I'm really confused about this, I don't know. And this one person called in and he said, I got two words for you, which are Missoula flood. And so I don't know what you're talking about. And in the last ice age, there was this huge ice dam formed in western Montana in the United States that made a lake that was basically most of western Montana. And at some point, the lake got so big, it lifted up the ice dam, and then the water flowed down the Columbia. And it was, I don't remember the numbers, but it's basically like 8 times as much water as all the water in the rest of the world that was flowing down rivers was flowing down the Columbia for like a month. Mm. It was a wall of water that was either 600 feet high and 80 miles an hour, 80 feet high, and I don't know how, it was huge. It was big enough that it was carrying boulders the size of houses for 500 miles. I mean, all the way down and then up the Willamette Valley. And it carved out these huge coulees up there. And they said, look, that was just a big flood and the river survived it. And the salmon survived it, the sturgeon survived it, and they're not surviving the dams. And so I started calling up some fisheries biologists and I said, I asked it differently this time. This time I said, okay, let's pretend that the entire economic system has collapsed. They no longer need the electricity from the dams. Dams just sitting there. And what should we do? The people in your community have enough explosives to take out the dam and they come to you and say, we want you to speak for the river. Would the river want the dam gone now or what? And they said, well, look, every dam is eventually going to fail. So it's a question of whether it collapses now or later. Every dam fails. And second, rivers get dammed all the time. There'll be big mudslides. There will be lava flows. The problem isn't that a river gets dammed. The problem is that every river gets dammed a bunch of times at the same time. And they said rivers break through dams. That's what they do. And every time they break through a dam, it's just a big flood. And that's what rivers do. So then that's all great. And then I was talking, and they all would say the same thing. It was just blah, 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 blah. And I talked to them from the perspective of the river. And I was talking to this one fisheries biologist up in Olympia, Washington, who works in this river and loves this one river. It's a wild river with no dams on it. And she said every time it floods, it breaks her heart. And it floods all the time. We misdefine rivers. We think that rivers just flow in place. But the truth is they ride a lot across the landscape like snakes. They dance across the landscape. They should be here this year, over here next year, over there the year after. That's what they do. And she said every time the river floods, it breaks her heart because it is killing all those trees, that's killing all the fish, it's killing all the salamanders, killing everybody who gets in, killing the deer that get caught in it. So it breaks her heart when it floods. And at the same time, it makes her really happy when it floods because every time it floods, that's making new habitat. And so she said this line, and this is the whole point of the story. She said this line, which is every time a river floods, it causes short-term habitat loss for long-term habitat gain. And when she said that, it gave me chills because I thought, why do we stay in jobs we don't like? Fear of short-term habitat loss for the long-term habitat gain. Why do we stay in relationships we're not happy in? Short-term habitat loss, long-term habitat gain. And why do we stay in this culture when at this point, everybody who is sane and paying any attention whatsoever and of decent heart recognizes that this way of life can't continue. And the only argument they have to keep it going is basically inertia. The only real argument, I mean, they can also argue, yeah, I like watching ESPN, but that's not a real argument. My personal entitlements is not an argument to kill the planet, although that's basically what a lot of this boils down to. Leaving that aside, there is this, we're already on the train, so we may as well go the rest of the way to the death camp. And that's not, I understand this fear of short-term habitat loss for long-term habitat gain. And that's fine in your personal life or in my personal life if we want to make those sacrifices. But when we're talking about life on the planet, we're talking about, I mean, there are stolid scientists who are saying the oceans could be devoid of fish in 30 years. This is just, this is insane.
We've heard that during the Paradigm Shift conference, which, by the way, our producer, Don Newsom and Doug Newsom, were with us. So he appreciates all of this as well. He's very much behind the scenes right now filming this, and he's a very earthy person. So I just wanted to put that in there.
So for me, the morality begins with we have to stop this culture from killing the planet. And I want to put in one more thing, and I also got this from Robert J. Lifton too, that It ends up being, yes, the basic morality is we have to stop this culture from killing the planet. But we also have to be aware that, as Robert J. Lifton also said, that before you can commit any mass atrocity, you have to convince yourself that what you're doing is in fact beneficial. You have to have what he called a claim to virtue. And so the Nazis were not actually committing genocide and mass murder from their perspective. They were purifying the Aryan race. The American settlers were not committing genocide and mass murder and land theft. They were manifesting their destiny. And today nobody's killing the planet. They are developing natural resources. And so that's just, I have to put this in as a very big important parenthetical comment, that when we talk about morality, we have to recognize the absolutely huge human capacity for self-deception. And so I can say the most important thing is to protect the land, and that's absolutely true. But anybody who does act also needs to be aware and I know in my own life, I have never once been a jerk. Never once have I ever been a jerk. By which I mean, every time I've been a jerk, I've had it fully rationalized. And, you know, they deserved it because they did this and this and this. You know, it's like, so we have this capacity. And I want for us, if we're going to talk about things like going after the industrial infrastructure, then we also have to have gone through a process of self-awareness to make sure that we don't just like blowing stuff up.
Good point.
Or we're not doing it because we're mad at somebody. It's like, I used to raise chickens because I eat meat, and if I'm going to eat meat, I need to be able to kill. I can't just push it off. And when I would kill a chicken, it was very sacred. You know, it's very, very difficult, frankly, for me. And the point is that I knew somebody one time who said, "Oh, I wish you would have told me that you were going to kill a chicken and eat it, because I was really mad at my boyfriend and I wanted to come over and get rid of some anger." And it's like, no, you would get nowhere near. That's absolutely inappropriate. So one should, I don't have a problem with hatred and I don't have a problem with anger, but I think that, as Che Guevara said, the real revolutionary must be motivated by love.
We need a heart-based intention in order to have rightful actions, so it doesn't become a harmful action to ourselves and others.
Well, it's really hard because it's, in many ways, I mean, I get hung up on the harmful action to self and others, because what do you do? I mean, the Nazis invaded Russia. You know, I don't have a problem with the Russians killing Nazis, and that's certainly harming another. And I don't have a problem with the defenders of the elephants killing the people who are trying to poach them. And and I'm not saying that lightly. It's very difficult. I mean, the whole question of doing no harm to others, it gets, okay, here's the deal. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, when I'm saying harmful action, I'm just playing off of what you said about it being based in love, whatever action you take, because I guess the harmful action comes when it's in anger. There's sort of an emotional and a spiritual and a mental harm or injury that's done within the action. I don't know, there's some kind of, you get what I'm saying, I guess. And yeah, I know Lana is always very concerned about that. If we're going to defend or protect anyone or anything or ourselves, it should be done from a place of compassion and love and kindness, rather than, like, if you have to kill an animal, maybe it's because that animal is suffering and it's going to die and it's just suffering, and you allowing it to suffer it is unkind, and there's no hope that you can save this animal no matter how much money you have. And it would, euthanasia is a kind killing.
But you could you could also say that maybe killing an animal for your own food is not love, it's selfish. And that, you know, you can argue that we should not be eating animals at all.
Well, we could make the same argument about plants, who are just ascension. But that's
I think so too. But
that's not the real direction. What I was trying to get at is that is that okay, for me, so when I wrote Endgame, I got a lot of flack from pacifists. And I joked to myself later that I should have written 1,000 blank pages with one page in the middle that says, sometimes it's okay to fight back, and call that endgame for pacifists, because that was the only thing they heard out of the entire book. And there's lots of other analysis in it. But as I was writing the book, and afterwards, I was in this one argument with one pacifist who said that she never wanted to do any act that harmed any other. And I said back to her, how do you defecate? Because every time you defecate, you're killing a bazillion bacteria who are perfectly happy in your guts. And now they're going to die out on the soil. And so what I realized is that the discussion I want to have about violence is this. Okay, we all agree that under most circumstances, it is morally acceptable to kill a carrot. Four of us, including the producer, agree that under most circumstances, it would be morally acceptable. This is not a trick question.
I don't know. I do think plants and trees and vegetation have consciousness and life and the vital essence.
I completely agree with you.
I do eat carrots. I need to eat. Yeah. We are consumers. Consumer is a funny word.
Yes.
But
yeah, so
I have to live. So I eat carrots. Yes.
Yeah.
I feel a bit guilty eating a carrot. I should become a sun gazer or an
breatharian.
Okay.
Well. But let's drop us out. And say most people under most circumstances would agree that killing a carrot's morally acceptable. People under most circumstances.
Yes.
And most people under most circumstances would also agree that it's not morally acceptable to kill a human being. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying what you and I think. I'm not saying all circumstances. I'm not saying it's not okay to kill Ted Bundy. I'm just saying most people under most circumstances.
Besides self-defense and in protection of the life of others, yes.
Yeah, so most people under most circumstances. Now, my point is, that what I'm really interested in then is, and what I think is an incredibly important discussion to have at this point, is what do we as a society and what do we as individuals, where do we draw those lines as to what is and isn't morally acceptable? So it would sound like, and this is perfectly fine, I'm just exploring this. It sounds like under most circumstances, Lana would find it unacceptable to kill an animal to eat. And that's perfectly fine. I have a different boundary on that.
I think I do too.
And that's all fine. The point is that we as a society evidently think it is more morally acceptable to kill the ocean than it is to impinge on corporate profits, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I really want to do, and that's why I'm not really interested in the particulars between the three of us, because the three of us, what is the problems of three people don't amount to a hill of beans in this big world, or however the line goes from Casablanca. But to start a larger conversation across society as to under what circumstances would it be acceptable to sink a whaling ship as Sea Shepherd did. It was in port. Nobody was hurt. Under what circumstances would it be okay to destroy a rail line? Under what circumstances would it be acceptable to? And we all have different lines on that. I was reading a book about a member of the Dutch resistance in World War II. Right near the end of World War II, he was tasked by other members of the Dutch resistance of blowing up a German troop train. Now, he knew this troop train was, at the end of the war, pretty much filled with German conscripts who were old men and young boys. But that didn't matter to him. He asked one question before he blew up the troop train, which is, are the engineers Dutch? And when he found out the engineers were German, I'm not saying that's okay or not okay. What I'm saying is, in that war, that was a decision he made, and he made it consciously. And what I love the line, unquestioned assumptions are the real authorities of any culture. And even though we disagree, Lana, I love the fact that you have thought about and developed an ethos associated with killing or not killing animals. Mm. And even though we may disagree on the particulars, I have so much more respect for that than somebody who would unthinkingly just either grab a hamburger or a tofu burger, it doesn't matter, who just takes what has been given to them. Because I think that, especially given what's at stake and what's going on with the world, we have to be asking these questions. What do we personally and socially find acceptable? I mean, for myself, again, I'm not meaning to push this too far, but it's like factory farming is under no circumstances. I mean, basically every factory farmer in the world should be should be put through their own farm. And, you know,
their death camps.
Yeah, take the cows out and put the farmers in. Not the farmers, the managers in, whatever you call them. It's like, that's a different, that's... So I really want to start those conversations of, and that's, you know, I'm bringing all this up because your first question was about morality. And so I think, and that's one of the things, but it's very difficult too. Even when we talk about, I want to say one more thing, which is even when we talk about self-defense, it gets really, the human capacity for self-deception is huge because the Germans claimed self-defense against the Poles when they attacked them, and they also claimed that they were killing the Jews because the Jews were a danger to the everybody. What's going on right now in the United States with the white supremacists are saying that the people of color, that everybody else is threatening their way of life, is threatening them. And we have, but the fact that humans have a great capacity for self-deception is, that's why I keep coming back to the land, because the land is real. And there really is, just because we can argue that, you know, say I work at a job and say my job is cutting down trees and somebody wants to take away that job by protecting those trees, I could then argue this is self-defense because I'm putting food on the table for my children. And that's true. That is true. But I also come back to this is the lives of the trees. That's why it's not a game because no matter what happens in life, somebody's going to end up winning and somebody's going to end up losing. If you have, except for honeybees and except for pollinators and plants, in which case everybody wins. But when you have a spider eating the bee, you know, the spider wins and the bee loses in that moment. It ends up being, I don't know, I'm feeling like I'm rambling now. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, something I wanted to say was it's not just an issue of morality. I mean, I think most people, or a large number of people, would be against corporates, the corporate system making profits and, you know, spoiling the land. But the issue is our degree of influence. We do not, your average person like us, maybe David and I, not so much you because you've built up at this organization, but most people do not have the degree of influence to actually do anything about it.
And this is why we do it as collectives,
or do we?
Well, I don't think we do. I mean, and when you say that I have an organization, this is like 200 people. I mean, there are fewer people in Deep Green Resistance than there are Major League Baseball players, and probably fewer people in Deep Green Resistance than there are rodeo clowns, for crying out loud. You know, it's like this is just. We could go through with all the absurd examples we want to of probably fewer people in DGR than there are professional mattress testers.
I guess it's something that could change.
Another reasons I wrote Endgame was because, and I used to start the Endgame talks this way, was I would ask people, how many of you believe this culture will undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living? Nobody would ever say yes. I asked thousands and thousands of people over the years that question. Do you believe the culture will undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living? Nobody says yes. The next question is, if you don't believe it's going to undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living, and you care about life on the planet, what does that mean for your strategy and for your tactics? And the answer is, we don't know. And one reason we don't know is because we're all so busy pretending that we have hope that there will be this magical shift. But I don't see it. And I don't see it happening in any sort of time frame that is helpful to the natural world. Yes, there might be a shift over 7 or 8 generations. You know, it's like I love the line and hate the line about some scientist. I can't remember which one it was right now. Max Planck, maybe, who said that the way that evolutions take place is not because the people on one side of the controversy convince the other, but because the people on one side of the controversy die of old age. And so, you know, you're not actually convincing other people, mm-hmm. but instead people grow up with a new paradigm. Mm-hmm. And I think in many ways, that's how social change takes place. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, salmon don't have that time. And so in many ways, that's what all my work is about if you, I mean, yes, I'm a writer for crying out loud. I do believe that we can affect some sort of change through words. Otherwise, I wouldn't be writing. But that's only one part. And one of the lines I'm most known for, one of my favorite lines, is every morning when I wake up, I ask myself whether I should write or blow up a dam. And what I'm getting at with that line is that writing is really important, but it comes back to the glass of water we talked about early on. Writing is really important, but writing by itself doesn't accomplish anything in the real world. At some point, somebody has to actually do something. And so it's the same with this discourse. I mean, I have so much respect for what you do, and I think you're doing incredibly important work with this radio program, but we all recognize that by itself, this radio program does not save Tasmanian devils, does not save kangaroos, doesn't save a single shark. But what we want is we want for people to listen to your work, my work, and then to go, gosh, maybe I can get off my butt today and I can go try to save some kangaroos and then work toward organizing to protect kangaroos or saltwater crocodiles or whom or orchids or whomever it is you're going to protect. And so I don't believe we're going to have a voluntary transformation, which means what I believe is that we need to, well, there are many things we need to do, and I don't want to get pegged as the guy who only says, let's go after the infrastructure, because I also believe in doing land rehabilitation. I believe in doing people rehabilitation. I believe it's really important to have, like, a good friend of mine used to run the Battered Women's Program for the state of New York, and that's incredibly important work. And I would never tell her, hey, stop doing that and go care about salmon. You know, it's like, that's one of the great things about everything being so messed up is no matter where you look, there's really great work done. And so there's, I mean, I think we need to do rehabilitation work. We need to protect the land. That's so important. It's like an environmentalist friend of mine says, I can't predict the future. So as things become increasingly chaotic, I want to make sure that some doors remain open. So if there's a dam going in Washington State right now that he and his wife are fighting like crazy, and they're doing this because if they can keep that dam out until the economic system completely collapses, the dam is out and the old growth trees behind the dam still stand. But if they can't stop it, those old growth trees are gone forever. If he can, so many environmentalists I know are just hanging on by our fingernails, hoping and praying that this or that creature survives until the culture collapses. And then one of the things I'm about is I want to say, okay, great. In addition, there should be some of us taking the offensive and some of us should be trying to collapse the system as quickly as possible to try to save whatever's left of the planet. I mean, I don't know if we talked about this before, but there's more than 450 dead zones in the oceans, and there's only one that has recovered. And the one that recovered, why? It's in the Black Sea, and it recovered because the Soviet Union collapsed, and it was no longer economically feasible to do agriculture along that part of the Black Sea coast. There's a solution right there. Collapse the economy, and this is what we would do. I mean, we talked about this before. If space aliens came from outer space and they were doing this, we would know what to do. And that's what we would do is we would see, here's the deal is I want for us to recognize that there's been a war waged on the natural world for the last several thousand years. And it's time we recognize that that is a war. And it's time we started treating it as a war and saying, I want to win. I mean, there's among the lefties and there's this concern like, oh my gosh, you want to win. That means somebody has to lose. Yeah, damn right. That's what happens in a war. One side wins, another side loses. And the side I want to win is the side that is for the salmon. And the side I want to win is for the Pacific lampreys. And the side I want to win is for the migratory songbirds. And for them to win, capitalism has to lose. Too bad, so sad. And so I was asked to talk to a board meeting of a company a while ago. And I'll go ahead and mention the company because they do great work. It's Patagonia. And I didn't know what to expect going in because, I mean, they do great work. And they're behind those national parks in South America. They have funded all sorts of wonderful, wonderful stuff. But still, it's a corporation. So I went in, and it was so cool because, you know, I'm not against civilization because I hate hot showers and Beethoven. I'm against this culture because it's killing the planet, and because I recognize that in order to have, that this computer didn't spring from nothing. This computer has a supply chain, and the supply chain includes killing mountain gorillas in the Congo and includes giving women cancer in Thailand. I can see how if you have metals, you have to have mining. And if you have mining, you have destroyed rivers. I can just follow. And the cool thing was that they are A, really environmental, and B, because they work in commerce, they understand chains of supply. And so a lot of times I will talk to people at talks or something, and I'll start talking about where do the metals come from for your car, for your bicycle, doesn't matter. And they don't know. But these people, since they work in this, they're fully recognized that if I make a jacket, that means that it's associated with supply chains all over the world. And the point in bringing this up is that we had a great talk. I really enjoyed it. And then the last question that the head of the company asked me was, and he wasn't going to give me money. He was just asking me to sort of clarify my position. He said, so if I could give you $20 million right now, what would you do with it? I said immediately, without hesitation, I would build a militant resistance to do strategic attacks on infrastructure. And it was so funny because the attorney who was there present, because of course it's a board meeting, the attorney said, we are not having this conversation. But I want to bring that into the conversation because here's the question I always ask. If salmon could take on human manifestation, how long would the Grand Coulee Dam last? If Delta Smelt could take on human manifestation, how long would the pumps on the Sacramento River last? If cows could take on human manifestation, how long would the slaughterhouses last? And so, you know, we can go through this with whatever your favorite being is. If carrots could take on human manifestation, how long? No, you joke. I'm not being a joke.
Attack of the killer tomatoes.
Well, how long would factory farming last?
Yes.
I mean, it wouldn't last for a minute because the plants are not having a good time either. No. In that, plants are not meant to grow in a row with Roundup dumped on them.
I mean, agricultural totalitarianism.
Yeah, that's not. And
not
so
the way it was meant to be.
So no, not at all. And the question I always ask is, you know, if redwood trees could take on human manifestation, what would they do? And I try to act the best I can in their interests.
I'm going to bring up something. Lana and I went to a Buddhist class last night, and the topic was around, it was the Heart Sutra, emptiness, and we got into talking about a few different things that are very relevant to what you're talking about. One was the idea of emptiness, and emptiness was that we are dependent on everything.
It was so sort of it's an emptiness of separation. In other words, the separation that we see about all things is an illusion, and we are intricately dependent on everything else.
And the process.
So the world is empty of the separate things that we see. It is, in fact, an interwoven web. And if people could see that, they would wake up to the fact that we are so dependent on nature. It's because we see ourselves as human beings as separate that we fall into this trap that, you know, we're not doing something about saving the planet, perhaps. We are under an illusion that we are more independent than we are.
And the process that they showed us was exactly what you were saying. When you look at something, and I've got a bottle of water, and you look at where this bottle of water came from, you start to look back and you see that the plastic came from a chemical company, and you look at all the implications and consequences of this bottle, which I should be reusing. And where did the water come from? How did the water get into it, et cetera? Where did the molecules, and then you can look all the way back in history and you begin to realize that there are many relationships and many forces and many factors going back thousands and thousands of years that produced this. And so it's our perception and our beliefs about this thing that we're seeing in front of us that's in error. It's not what we think it is. And therefore, we're actually, everything is very dependent, and everything, I guess.
This is one reason, by the way, that I absolutely hate zoos, because zoos say that they're trying to teach you about animals, but they're teaching you the wrong lesson. They're trying to teach you that you can remove a wolverine from its habitat and still have a wolverine. They're trying to teach you that a wolverine is muscles inside a sack of skin, as opposed to being the scent on the air and all the relationships that the wolverine has with every other being in its community. And that is incredibly harmful to think, okay, I can see a wolverine in a box right here. I can take five steps and see a cheetah in a box. And that's no longer a wolverine. It's no longer a cheetah. And this is no disrespect to the creatures in there. This is that the creatures are being misdefined, just like we talked about rivers being misdefined earlier. That the river is not just this channel through which water flows. You have the Los Angeles River is a concrete sluice. That is not a river. A river is all the interactions between the river and all the surroundings. You know, one of the things I used to read at my talks is a section called Pretend You're a River. And if you haven't read it, read it. It's one of the most beautiful things that I've written. And I didn't actually write it, interestingly enough. It was written by the river itself, by which I mean I didn't write it next to the river. The river wrote it for me. The stream wrote it for me. I was trying to think, what is it like to be a river? And then which I think is the most important question in any relationship, is to ask, what is it like to be you? I think we don't ask that often enough in even our romantic relationships, but it's an incredibly important question. What is it like to be you? And so I'm trying to figure out what it's like to be a river. And I think, well, this is really stupid. I live about 50 yards from a stream. So I walked down the stream. I said, what is it like to be you? And man, the stream gave it to me right away. And the point, look it up. It's all over the internet. Pretend you're a river. And the point right now has to do with, that's all true, what I just told you. But the other thing that's true is, before then, I was trying to think, how can I define something? When you define something, what you're doing by definition is separating it from everything else. So if I say, this is a Volkswagen Beetle, I now tell you what a Volkswagen Beetle looks like by defining it separate from
exactly
a Ford Mustang. It doesn't matter. And I was thinking, okay, can I write something where it's I'm not defining something by what it isn't, but instead defining something by the permeability of its boundaries. And that whole section ends up being that. I can't remember the whole piece, but some of it is like, pretend you're a river, pretend you are the mist who falls so fine, so gentle, that there is no separation between water and air. And you are the stones the water seeps into. And the point was that it was all about how the stream is not just water in a box. Mm-hmm. Instead, the stream is every interaction that the water has.
Beautiful.
And that's there's one more piece that I want to bring up that I think is really important, which is that one of the reasons that we don't resist is because if your experience, not your thought, not your heart, but if your experience is that your food comes from the tap and your water, or your water comes from a tap and your food comes from the store, you're going to defend to death the system that brings those to you, because your life depends on it. And if, on the other hand, your food comes from a land base and your water comes from a river, you'll defend to the death those, because your life depends on those. And one of the things that the capitalist system has done, and the industrial system and the civilized system has done from the very beginning intentionally, has separate us from the land and make us dependent upon the system, which is why you end up with people saying, honestly and truthfully, I need this job. And the reason they need this job is because they can no longer go down to the river. Like, I know this woman who used to be married to a guy from Bangladesh, who even 20 years ago, his mother would say to him, can you go down to the river and catch us some lunch? And he would go down and catch a fish for lunch. The river is now so polluted that they get their fish from Iceland, which is what the capitalist system does. It makes you dependent on the system. So that they can say, look, you need to cut down these trees, but you wouldn't have to cut down the trees if there were, and I don't care what you eat, it's whatever foods are there. If you could eat the food in the forest, then you wouldn't need to cut down the trees. And they've known this from the beginning. There was a pro-slavery philosopher in the 1830s who wrote a letter to his northern abolitionist buddies saying, look, there's land ownership conditions in which we have to own the slaves and land ownership conditions in which it's not in the capitalist's best interest to own them. Very simple. If there's a lot of land and not many people, people have access to land, which means they have access to food, clothing, and shelter, which means they have access to self-sufficiency, which means the only way you can get them to go to work for you is to point of a gun. On the other hand, if you have a lot of people and not much land, then people don't have access to land, which means they don't have access to food, clothing, and shelter, which means that they don't have access to self-sufficiency, which means they will go to work for you for whatever pittance, and it's actually much better not to own them, which is why the Indian, John Mohawk, says there is no sovereignty without food sovereignty.
That's a very important point, really important point.
So that's one of the reasons that we, so, you know, I don't, this is where I and the permaculture movement come together, is because where I disagree with, so a lot of the bigwigs in the permaculture work, or some of them at least, really love my work and I love their work. But there are some people in the permaculture movement, especially sort of the some younger sort of acolytes, some people are really excited about it. They just found out about it. They think that permaculture by itself can save the planet. But no, gardening by itself is not going to save the planet. Mm. It is one part of resistance. It has to be. Kropotkin said that so many revolutions have failed because of bread. Because if you can't feed the people revolting, they're going to stop revolting and go back to the system. And so permaculture is incredibly important. Mm. As one part of the resistance,
it's one aspect,
feeding the resistance. We need to get that self-sufficiency so that we can resist.
We had this conversation yesterday at class as well, when I asked, you know, there are people who believe, and I guess you'd call them pacifists, who believe that if we meditate and we send positive energy out to the universe, healing vibrations, that alone is activism, and that is enough to save the planet. And we know many people who believe that, and I believe that's true. And then, but we asked one of the women who had been at this class for more than 15 years, and they said, what about the activists who believe, you know, they're not taking action and they're not doing anything? And she said, well, I think we need both, and we need to appreciate both, because one without the other is bound to fail, I would think. It's not, I don't know, she had another way of putting it, but I do believe that everybody has a role, and it is very important to send out positive thoughts, and at the same time, it's important to take positive action. And so, geez, I guess we could have a lot more conversation.
Well, I'd like to get down to the practicality of what we can do, what we should be doing.
Maybe we need to, you know, have another conversation about that, because we had a lot of conversations around yesterday about values and ethics, and what's the difference between the life of a spider and the life of a cow, and et cetera, and those questions that we ask ourselves. And that's what this show was about, I think, asking the
I mean, I guess I think the things that you have said are a real wake up to how we're living in our illusion. So thank you very much.
Thank you,
Derek. We've
got
to finish up now, but thanks for talking about such a important topic.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, and I'm sorry we didn't get more to the specifics. We'll do that another time. And thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Thank you to the producer too.
Okay. Thanks, Derek. And so this is Detective David Love.
Dr. Lana Love from Universal Soul Love.
On the BBS Radio Network.
Saying goodbye to everyone. Till next week.
Lots of love. Bye for now. Bye, Derek. Thank you.
See you.